recently we went through the, we looked at the characters of Elijah and then of Elisha. And I thought I'd like to take another character again. The reason why I'm doing this is to do something different in each of the meetings, really. We went through Romans, which is quite, well, a lot of thinking to be done as we go through on a Sabbath morning, and various other meetings. And I thought for a little while we would look at another character, at Moses. And observing things like this as we go along, more than the actual events, consider how God is working in Moses and influencing his life and preparing him for a great work, and consider also how he's delivering his people. There's more than just Moses here. Although it says Moses is, as we have here, as a center figure, yet it's as he is in the plan of God. No worker is indispensable. That God can choose whom he will, when he will, you know, and do a great work. But something to notice, first of all, before we go on to there, is the end of Genesis. In verses 24 to 26, now you remember it's the account of Joseph there and how he had found himself in that situation in Egypt and had risen to a place of great, a position of great importance and trusted by Pharaoh, and his wisdom had been profound and helpful, and how his family eventually came to him. Sometimes I've compared the church of God as a thread, or you could say sometimes it's like as fragile as a thread of silk, and other times it's strong as rope, or as thick as rope. There are times when the church on earth seems to be numerically few, and perhaps even spiritually weak on times, and other times are times of great awakening and refreshing and encouragement. But we must always remember that that thread will never snap, because it is God's cord. And I get great comfort in that, in such a day as we are in a day of great declension. Let's not be unaware of the situation in Wales and generally in these islands. Realistically, less than 2% attend any kind of place of worship, which we call, might call Christian in a very broad sense, from Roman Catholic to all the various sects that you can think of, less than 2%. And when you think then, and you only have to think of it really, think of your own street where you live, how many attend a place of worship, and then work out how many of those are evangelical. And from the evangelical, work out how many of those are based on the doctrines of grace and biblical evangelicalism. Then work out from amongst them how many of them have a burden for the things of God. And you come down to very few. I'm right, aren't I? Come down to that. We don't want to dwell on that. And I want us to think of things differently. And I want to introduce this thought to you. That if we think of our age now as a time, oh, it was better when I was young. Well, it was. But we shouldn't think like that. It was better because at that time, the benefits of great revivals were still to be felt. Now, that's not the norm. That's the unusual. And so what we have declined from that, certainly. But if you go to the times before revival, times just like we're in today, what a waste of time it is just to dwell on the past, other than to learn from the past. That's useful, very useful. But to dwell on it and say, oh, how poor is our lot, how terrible it is, then we won't do anything. We'll just sit down and weep. But if we recognize that this is how it is, but God is on the throne. Now, we're not in revival. We're not in any kind of awakening. Nothing like that at all. But he might have one for us. You know? If we could talk to the people in 1700, in Wales, particularly vile in its behavior and low in its morals, and the church was in an appalling state, And yet, you see, we are able to tell them before long, God is going to call William Williams Pantycillin and Howell Harris and Daniel Rowlands. Then in England, people like the Westleys and George Whitfield and so on. And of course, Jonathan Edwards in New England. But in that time, they didn't know that, did they? You see. And suppose they spent their time mourning a previous blessing. Now, that's all right, just to say there have been better times. But isn't it better to think what God can do in a hopeless situation? Isn't that better? What he's able to do. Now, if you want a hopeless situation, I can tell you of one here now. Verses 22 to 26 to begin with. And Joseph dwelt in Egypt, he and his father's house. And Joseph lived 110 years. And Joseph saw Ephraim's children of the third generation, the children also of Machir and the son of Manasseh, were brought up upon Joseph's knees. And Joseph said unto his brethren, I die. And God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land, unto the land which you swear to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And that was far away. And Joseph took an oath of the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and he shall carry up my bones from hence. So Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. But now then, what happens next? You see, a new king comes. There's been a long period, hasn't there? A very, very long period. And Joseph is soon forgotten. And the presence of the children of Israel is no longer appreciated. And they are strangers in a foreign land. And you cannot be in a worse situation that you are unwelcome guests in another country, far away from what God has promised you, what you hope will be realized one day, and with a king or a pharaoh who's getting increasingly nervous at your presence. It's a terrible situation. And it worsens for them as well. I'll just go through the reading quickly. And all the souls that came out of the loins of Jacob were 70 souls, for Joseph was in Egypt already. And Joseph died, and all his brethren, and all that generation. And the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied, and waxed exceeding mighty, and the land was filled with them. Now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. And there's your problem. You know? So you might say, well, what are we... How we might say to God, well, is this thread going to break here now? Is this going to be the end of the plan of God, and will he have to start afresh somewhere? What will he do? Now then, what we notice in the work of God is this. He loves to confound the wisdom of the wise. And out of nothing he can create, and out of a hopeless situation he can bring deliverance. Now here's his new king, and he doesn't like them. And he said unto his people, behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. That is, they're too many and they're a nuisance. Come on, let us deal wisely or cunningly with them, lest they multiply. And it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us, and so get them up out of our land. We are indeed, they don't realize it yet, but they are a very real threat to us. That's worse. So God's people now are not only in a strange land. The reason why they are there is forgotten. Their favorite Joseph has long been forgotten. And antagonism is growing against them increasingly. I wonder how they felt. You see, it was a very real situation then. To us, we can brush over these verses so quickly and think, ah yes, well, God raised Moses and he did this, that and the other. But just think of what they went through as people, as little families, as fathers and mothers and so on. And they set over them taskmasters. And they had to build cities. And they had to work hard. But the harder they worked, the more children they seemed to have, and the more they multiplied. And the Egyptians made the children of Israel, in verse 13, to serve with rigor. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar and in brick and in all manner of service in the field. All their service wherein they made them serve was with rigor. So they've gone now from being the favored family of Joseph, who had delivered Egypt from great plagues and great famine, to be the people who are not wanted, who are hated, and there is great antagonism in the land. What can God do? And what will God do? Well, the king of Egypt certainly doing plenty. He has an idea. Let's stop them having sons. I find this part very interesting. And he tells the midwives that when you see a boy being born, kill him instantly. So we'll begin to start weakening the population of these children of Israel. So when you do the office of a midwife, just do that. Kill them. Then we have here some little inclination. I used to wonder how much was there left of the faith amongst these people after this very, very long period. How much was there left there? You know, it can fade so very, very easily and soon be forgotten. And people can be going through a ritual that they've long since forgotten its meaning. I can remember many years ago, I was a teenager, early 20s, I don't remember, but I read the book, I was about 15 or 16. It was called The Gobi or The Gobi Desert. Do you know the book by Mildred Cable and Francesca French? Remember? An interesting book, and of their travels there. And in some part of China, they come across a secret society. Do you remember that? And this secret society met, and all that they did was to drink weak tea and eat a biscuit. And so they asked them, why do you do this? Well, we don't really know, except that a long time ago somebody did something for us, but we don't know what. Can you see what was left? Some form of Christian church at one time, and just a little semblance, like a shadow, a shade left. Somebody, somewhere, did something for us. I wonder how much these people remembered. I think a little more. Not a great deal generally, I'm sure. But it's something that the midwives were told, that they disobeyed Pharaoh. Now then, to disobey Pharaoh. But the midwives feared God, and did not as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the men children alive. Ah, something. You see, Pharaoh, you think of that time. You know, a king hadn't got to have a trial. If you disobeyed, it was instant death. Well, that was it. There's no argument. You couldn't say that you were allowed to have any representative or any lawyer or counsel of some kind to help you and defend you and bring some kind of case that you might be escape the judgment. Not at all. It would be at the whim and the fancy of a king. But they disobeyed Pharaoh. He asked them, why? Why do you do this? Why should you disobey me? And they said, well, they seem to give birth so very easily. And therefore, God dealt with the midwives, and the people multiplied and waxed very mighty. And it came to pass, you know, twice he tells them this, as we know. And it came to pass, because the midwives feared God, that he made them houses. And Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, everyone that is born, you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive. Now, all I want from that is this. That all that we can see is total hopelessness. A people with only a vague memory of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and even a vague memory of Joseph, really, practically speaking. But there was something left of the acknowledgement of Jehovah. For these midwives feared God. They knew that they were not as the Egyptians, that they were different. Well, how can they be helped? And as we go on, we know what a struggle it's going to be. A very hard and a long struggle. But look at the way that our God goes about it. He doesn't get an army from another country to save them. He doesn't send a legion of angels to save them. It's to do with a little baby. It starts there. Such a vulnerable situation there. How easily it can be for the child to die. How easy to be destroyed. How easy, because there was a savour of death in the air. So, and then even in the preservation of this child, they didn't know that this child, that God had his hand on him. That's the amazing thing. We know, don't we? We know, because we're looking at it in retrospect. We know that. But they didn't know that. I often think of people like Martin Luther and John Calvin and so on. You see, they didn't know they were great. They didn't know that. George Whitfield didn't know that he was great. They only knew that they preached. And that, you remember, if you just remember how it was, think of Howell Harris now then, when he preached in Carnarvon town, that they began to stone him, and he escaped by simply getting a rowing boat and rowing right into the Menai Strait away. What did he do? He came back and preached again. You know, if you just say, oh, I wish I was Howell Harris, said, do you? You know, at that time, they didn't know. They didn't know. And we're able to say afterwards, looking back, yes, we thank God for those people. And here's the beginning here. And there went a man of the house of Levi and took to wife a daughter of Levi. And the woman conceived and bare a son. When she saw that he was a goodly child, she hid him 3 months. When she could not longer hide him, she took for him an ark of bulrushes and daubed it with slime, and with pitch, and put the child therein, and she laid it in the flags by the river's brink. Well, we all know that in our children's Bible years ago, there was a picture of this in every children's Bible I can remember. It was one of the one that, I used to have a very big children's Bible, this one page was nearly worn to pieces and full of thumb marks, and I tell you which it was, David and Goliath. I was terrified of it. I'd open it quickly and shut it, you see, but my hand would be on it, and I'd hide the face and so on. And with this one, I like to look at this one, and this one's a well-worn page as well. I still got that Bible, actually. A well-worn page. Big, big thing. And she hid it. What future could there be? Dangerous thing to do, to have a little boy running around at such a time as this. And his sister stood afar off to it, what would be done to him. Now, we know the story, don't we? Now, the daughter of Pharaoh doesn't particularly mean that she was very important, reasonably important, because there would be some very royal princesses. She'd be one of the lesser ones, probably. And she's by the river, and they see the child, and she just falls in love with the child. Why? Well, I think God made her, you know. He led her to the child. How was God going to save this child? Now, if you had said like this, now, how shall I save this child of bulrushes? Shall we take him to another country or the border? What should we do? How shall we get him to the border? Would you ever have thought, God said, I'm going to arrange from one of the house of the king of Pharaoh to be in charge of him. Well, it's the last place, is it? No? Your enemy territory. You see, it's wonderful. When you really think about it, think of these things that you're very familiar with now, and think of the wonder of it, that God is going to work his miracle in a very dangerous place. And you say, well, God, you know, really be careful about this, because Pharaoh's a very bad-tempered man. He's not a bit nice, and he kills people. Look at all the little children he's had killed. He's absolutely without mercy. I wouldn't have any of his family get near the child. That's what I would say if I were advising God. But God's ways are above our ways. And she had compassion on him. Listen, and when she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the babe wept, and she had compassion on him, and said, "This is one of the Hebrew children." And she knew exactly what she was doing. She was risking, wasn't she? Great risk here. And she says to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call to the nurse of the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for thee?" And this is lovely here. And the maid went and called the child's mother. And so there's a remarkable situation here. And Pharaoh's daughter said unto her, "Take this child away and nurse it for me, and I will give thee thy wages." And the woman took the child and nursed it. So not only does she have charge of her own child, she also gets national benefits. You know, doesn't she really? You know, she wouldn't have any other allowance normally, would she? But here she's having an allowance to bring up her own child. And God does things. He does them very, very well. The child grew. And she brought him unto Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she called his name Moses. And she said, "Because I drew him out of the water." It came to pass in those days. Now then, we come then, don't we? That is the early beginnings of things. Now then, here is the thing now, you might say, what a sad thing that he did. But remember, what does he know? He will know what his mother will have told him. But how much would she really know when religion is faded like it would have been then? And when they were so far away. Well, he did some things, and you might wonder, well, why did he do this? And yet you can understand as well. It came to pass in those days, and Moses was grown, that he went out into his brethren and looked on their burdens, and he spied an Egyptian smiting in Hebrew one of his brethren. You see, he knew he was a Jew. He knew because of his mother brought him up. How much she told him, who can tell? But he knew that he was not an Egyptian. And it hurt him to see how God's people were suffering. It really hurt him. And it went to his heart. And you have to understand that, to understand his actions. And he saw these Egyptians being so cruel. He looked on this way and that way. And when he saw that there was no man, he slew the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. And he was wrong to murder a man. We don't know what kind of spiritual experience he has here. Maybe you have to wait a little longer before we see that. But he has a natural protective instinct regarding his own people. But it does not serve him well. Or maybe in God's plan it does. When he went out the second day, behold, two men of the Hebrews strove together. And he said, "This is terrible. Believer fighting believer. This is terrible. A Hebrew fighting a Hebrew. I cannot bear this." It was bad enough seeing the Egyptians. I felt I did what I could, but I cannot cope with my own brethren fighting one another. And he said to him that did the wrong, "Wherefore smitest thou thy fellow? Why did you do such a thing?" A terrible thing to do. And he said, "Who made thee a prince and a judge over us? Intendest thou to kill me as thou killed the Egyptian?" And Moses feared and said, "Surely this thing is known." And really, you could say it's from then on, his story begins in that very real way. The background, you can see the deliverance of God, the preservation of God, and God preparing his answer already for the people of God. Nobody would have thought that this little child hidden there was going to be God's chosen child. Nobody would have thought that. And he did these things. You might say, well, couldn't you change the story a little and left that murder out? No, it's put. You see, that's the wonderful thing about the Bible. It doesn't hide anything about it. It shows us what we are, what's and all, everything exactly as we are. And so it shows him doing this. We can understand why he was angry with the Egyptian. Cannot condone it, but we can understand when he knows he's in trouble. Now when Pharaoh heard this thing, he sought to slay Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. And you remember there's that lovely account there where he's... I'll read it quickly through, I don't want to stay on this. Now the priests of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. And the shepherds came down and drove them away. But Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. So he did a favor. And when they came to Reuel, their father, he said, "How is it that he has come so soon today?" They said, "An Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds and also drew water enough for us and watered the flock." And he said unto his daughters, "And where is he? Why is it that he have left the man? Call him that he may eat bread." Now, can you see here again? I do not think for one moment that Moses is motivated in helping, other than motivated by kindness and seeing how roughly and unjustly these shepherds were. But there again you can see the hand of God. There are two levels, aren't there? Circumstances, as they happen, up and down, back and forth, as things are, and then the hand of God, and you look back and see what God did out of that, or what God planned in that, whichever way you look at it. He said, "Call him that he may eat bread." And Moses was content to dwell with the man. And he gave Moses Zipporah, his daughter. And she bare him a son. He called his name Gershom. He said, "I have been a stranger in a strange land." And that's where he is. Isn't it hopeless? They're still being dealt rigorously by the Egyptians, other people of God. He's had to leave them. He's done some bad thing. It is understandable. He's been discovered for it. He's distressed by the behavior of his own people. A little act of kindness. And God has provided a home for him for a while. Do you notice something here? God is never in a hurry. That's right. He's never in a hurry. You know, that's a wonderful thing. I think the reason why I'm a poor gardener, and you probably know I'm a poor gardener, is because I'm in a hurry. I want an instant garden, you know. I can remember I started once by buying lots of packets of seeds, those lovely, lovely colours on them, and just scattered them around like this, expecting to see a great floral display. But that's not how to garden. And my father-in-law was an excellent gardener. He was so slow. You know, he used to go steadily. And so the soil was almost like powder, you know. But by the time he'd finished, you had a lovely garden. He took his time. I could never make a gardener. I just wanted like that. But a gardener knows he takes time. And here you see God takes time. You have to take time with an individual, with a character. How quickly do you learn spiritual things yourself? Maybe quick in some ways. I'm a slow learner. And sometimes he has to teach me the same lesson a few times. And each time a little bit more severe before I get the message. But are we willing to learn, you know? Now he deals with this man. But he doesn't know that he's going to be used, does he? He doesn't know. He doesn't know how he can help. I think his heart is aching for his people. But there he has a home now. And it came to pass in process of time that the king of Egypt died. And the children of Israel sighed by reason of the bondage. And they cried, and their cry came up unto God by reason of the bondage. And this is the part I really want to come to tonight. I'm not going to hurriedly, but I've gone through that part, which I know you're very familiar with it. But I do want you just to see the hand of God there. And now to what seems to be a hopeless situation, that he still is in charge. And that golden thread, whatever it may be called, however slender it may be, it'll never snap, because it's God's cord and it's safe. And it's ever so important to remember that. And that's why we should not fear in such a day as this. Well, they sighed. Now, then, by reason of the bondage, and they cried, and their cry came unto God by reason of the bondage. God heard their groaning. And here's the lovely thing now. There are his people, day in, day out, week in, week out, slaving and being beaten and being whipped by these Egyptians, cruelly treated and savagely by the murder of their little boys, all that. And they groaned, a real heart groan. It's as if they were saying, "We are thy people, and the sheep of thy pasture. We haven't got there yet, have we? We don't groan yet. I don't know what it takes. I don't know how long it takes. The only groans we have sometimes is somebody very close to us, in any of our families, mine or anybody, shows no interest in the things of God, and their end is near. You groan. You know, we groan for them, and rightly. But when have we groaned for the state of the church? For the way the evangelical church behaves today. The casual, indifferent, irreverent way she addresses God. The careless way. The thoughtless way. And it seems to be an emphasis in these days where people need us to be, they need a tonic, they need to be happy. And we have happy clappy evangelicalism. But when the burdens go great, you're not happy clappy. We begin to groan. It takes quite a while for God to bring his people that they actually groan. And their groan is a strange one. It's to God, and they hardly know in what direction they're groaning. They just know, oh, this is wrong. This is so terrible, the situation that we're in. But this is a good thing. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God had respect unto them. Now, who are we? We belong to a covenant of grace. We're greatly privileged. This generation that we are in, we have seen. I'm not bothered about liberal theology, because that is a straight denial of the gospel, and it's quite simple to understand. It's just a plain denial. And we mentioned many times, and it was the German higher critical school, not blaming the Germans, that could have happened anywhere. In 1830, the higher critical school came, and its basis was not scholarship, remember. It was, we must adapt the gospel to suit 19th century man. So we must subtract from it all that is supernatural and all that will not meet man's rationale and reasonable thinking. Human thinking. So anything that was miraculous was out. And with it went the spiritual. And then they get the scholarship to fit that. And so it went on. So I'm not so concerned about that. That's done its evil work. But concerned about evangelicalism, when it's not worshipping God, but when they're having a hilarious time, it bothers me. And it's not a matter of being old-fashioned and things are new. I insist that those are not the words. It's a matter between being faithful and unfaithful. That's the line. Things that are new are not bad or good because they are new. Things that are old are not bad or good because they're old. But you keep in the old that which is good, and that which is in the new that which is good. You know? It isn't the matter if anything is beyond that here, we jettison that. It's not that. It's whether we are faithful to the fundamental principles of the things of God. We have wandered a long way. He still has his people. But we haven't got to that groan yet. But they groaned. And this great God of ours had respect unto his people. So now we have the picture. God has been in the picture all along. He's concerned about his people. They're in Egypt. They were preserved for a time there because of the famine, if you remember. And the story as we've gone through it now. And Moses, and he had to grow up to a certain age. And then he had to go away, and all those years that went there. But they are now, the people are beginning to think and to groan, and the reality of things. God now, as if he came, shall I put it, he's there all the while in all that plan, more obvious, more into the open. So we have a lovely account now. He's now going to deal with Moses. Now Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. He led the flock to the backside of the desert and came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb. and the angel of the Lord. Now then, remember now, when we have the phrase the angel of the Lord in the Old Testament, it says a reference to our Lord Jesus Christ. You know that, don't you? Otherwise it says angel or angel or something else. But angel of the Lord. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. So he's not had anything like that before. You know, nothing miraculous or startling has ever happened to him before. He didn't seek it. He didn't expect it. He hadn't even dreamt about it. It happened. Now then, that's how he works. It comes a time in the history of church or an individual when, in a way, unsought in a sense, other than we desire that the people of God might be preserved in some way, and then something remarkable happens. And in the Old Testament particularly, there are these special appearances. I am not saying that in great revivals that there were not manifestations. There were manifestations there as well. But here, in a particular way, that is so. The Lord appeared unto him. And we are given the description. This burning bush. What would you do? How do you react to that? As far as he's concerned, he is one of the fortunate ones that escaped the massacre of boy babies, and that he was brought up by one of the princesses in Pharaoh's court, or cared for in a way, and as a son eventually. He'd had everything. As many chariots as he liked, really. He'd had quite a good time. Then he began to look at his people and hurt for them. It hurt him. He was hurting for them. They didn't seem to be so bothered about him, even though it was an Egyptian that they killed. They said, who are you to judge us when we are fighting? You're nobody. You're a nothing. But he has to run away from the anger of Pharaoh. God cares for him. I am a stranger in a strange land. Think of that phrase. Very much like Elijah with his chariot in a way, isn't it? I'm a stranger in a strange land, where he was very much alone. I wonder how often he thought about Jehovah. What was in his mind? There must have been much. He's faced with this. And Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight. And why the bush is not burnt? It's the most strange thing. How can a bush burn and yet not be reduced to ashes? How can that be? No ordinary fire. No ordinary manifestation. And when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called unto him out of the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. Oh, how many wonderful and lovely times in the scriptures, and you can think of when God calls. Can you think of them? Remember Samuel? Right? You can think of many, can't you? Lovely instances. Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? Where there have been confrontations like that, and we are given some of them. And he calls him by name. And he said, here am I. It's a wonderful thing to be able to say. Well, this is all there is of me. Here am I. What a precious, precious moment. Do you remember, there are so many hymns I like. I suppose they all express something that has meant something to somebody at some time, as well as to us when we... Do you remember these words? I think it's right hymn. Yes. I see thee not, I hear thee not, yet thou art oft with me. And earth hath ne'er so dear a spot as where I meet with thee. I was thinking on Sunday, you know, when you're not preaching, it's, you know, I think it's nice for you, you know. I'd love to be in the congregation and listening. I like that. And to be there. Because there, although it's lovely to preach, it's lovely. I tell you the moment I like, you know, on a Sabbath morning, when we get up, that moment, come let us to the Lord our God with contrite heart return. Well, it does something to me. And you know, at night when we sing the other introit that we have, we love the place, O God, wherein thine honour dwells. Now, wherever we are as a family, that time I'm thinking they're getting up now. And they're saying that. I got it wrong in America first time. One Sunday morning I got up, I was determined to pray. And after I prayed, I realised that you'd all had your dinner. You know, I always get it wrong. Mass has never been my strong point. And I thought, well, it doesn't matter. With God, prayers can go backwards, I'm sure. I was hoping so. But I tried to work out the time and almost kind of enter into it. And then yesterday, it was so lovely to look around. Not at people particularly, I don't mean that. You get to love the place, don't you? I know it's only a building. And we could have another building, I know that. But associations, you know, lovely associations, those who come to the Lord. And even, don't mistake me, even funerals. You know, I'm getting old enough to say this now. Everybody I bury now is a friend. Am I right? I love them, you know, my friends. And it's kind of very precious, that little place in the front. People get married there. There's a funeral there. Little babies are dedicated there. Do this in remembrance of me in the communion service. We do there. And earth has ne'er so dear a spot as where we meet with thee. And that's why I think I love something about a place of worship. And I suppose I'm very reserved by nature. I don't know, I suppose you are too. But in any case, I love reverence. In Welsh chapels, those of you Welsh speak will know, they have this big verse in the front, Sancteiddrwydd a berthynas di, holiness belongs to thy house, O God. And I feel like that, you know. Holiness belongs to his house. Well, he's there. Here am I. And he said, draw not nigh hither, but put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. Now, you know what's coming next. I can't resist it. I can't help it. The night I was converted. You know, I was very worried about my conversion afterwards, whether it was really authentic, you know, because I would love to have been led to the Lord by somebody else, but I wasn't. I'd been groaning for some time, knowing that there was a great gap there. And my brother had come to see me, and we'd had an argument. It's terrible, isn't it? You know, brothers do. I don't know what we argued about, but I had to catch the last bus to where I was going at 5:30, and arriving there at 7:15, and, you know, leaving and feeling unhappy that he'd come to see me for the weekend, and we'd argued about something silly, and I felt sad about it. Wish we hadn't argued. It was entirely my fault, so I was always arguing. And then I was met by this lady and her daughter. I was staying in the chapel house in Pont Erwyd. Oh, it's a, well, better be careful. It's a quiet place, tiny village, about 5 or 6 houses, something like that. And the old lady was nice too. And I always wanted to know about the revival. And I knew the difference between godly people and others. And said, were you in the revival? Oh yes, she said, I was in the revival. You were? She said, this place was full. And she described the meetings. But if you ask me, she said, it didn't mean a thing to me. I looked at her. And we have a Welsh hymn that says, how dreadful to be in the midst without being able to praise. That's terrible. And it frightened me, you know, that you could be in the midst and feel nothing. Awful. Anyway, she was kindly enough and had supper, usual simple cast of cheese or something, and in the parlour, they always have big asbestos in the windows there. Usual kind of thing. I said, what shall I do for the whole evening now, sitting here? And then I thought, I'll pray. I wasn't a Christian. I'll pray. the room, I don't know, I'm afraid of exaggerating, was filled with the presence of God. I knew he was there. I didn't see anything. I didn't hear anything. I don't want to exaggerate. But I knew he was there. And all that I'd known clicked into place. And I just said in Welsh, "Oh Lord, you're terrific." Just like that. But what should I do? And you know what I did? I took my shoes off. And still at home, I cannot pray with my shoes on. I don't know why it is. It's as if there was a kind of a respect to take your shoes off. And knelt and prayed. And he came to me. And the text was, seek, ask, knock, ask, seek, knock, you know it? And my sermon is run on. The virtue was, you go on asking, seeking and knocking. And the virtue was asking, seeking and knocking. Not the finding or the door opening. And I can remember trying to explain out the little notes I had. What's the point of asking if you don't expect an answer? What's the point of seeking unless you intend to find? What's the point of knocking unless you expect the door to be opened? And I was pouring my heart out to all five in the congregation. And then to two in the afternoon. And then to two in the evening. It didn't matter to me. And earth hath ne'er so dear a spot as where I meet with thee. I can understand why he did that. You know, I can understand. Because you feel you're in his presence. What should I do? What should I do? And I think it's a wonderful thing if we can to keep up that reverential awe. We want to restore again a generation of people who fear God. Now that's a very unpopular thing to say. But a generation that fear God. Now that's not the fear of the world, panic and that kind of nonsense. Not that. But he is God after all. And if we this moment, that it was our moment of death, I had to appear before God. Now what will it be like, you know? His immensity, his vastness, his greatness, his purity, and the wonder of his person. And I can't cheat. And I can make no excuses. There have to be total honesty. Because nothing else can be other than that. I have to be real. When you think like that, although perfect love casteth out fear in the worldly sense, let us never lose the deepest, tenderest fear that we always ought to have towards God. Reverence. And he said, draw not nigh hither, but put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. Isn't it a lovely account? You know, and for this man, it would have been absolutely unforgettable. Go back now to verse 24, chapter. He heard their groaning and God remembered his covenant. The word remember doesn't mean suggest that God had forgotten. It's not that. He's speaking to us in human terms. His covenant comes to light again. With whom? With Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. Abram, Isaac and Jacob. We don't make headlines unless it is for some criticism or other, but we don't make headlines. But can you remember the last half a dozen prime ministers in sequence quickly like that, or the presidents of the United States or of Russia or whatever? Could you remember them 1, 2, 3, 4 just like that? You'd have to think, was he before this and what did he do? Oh yes, he was faithful to that. You'd have to think hard. Yet at the time, they were headlines. They were news. They're soon forgotten, aren't they? They're soon forgotten. But this work of God goes on. You know, there's no such thing as forgetting about it. It's a living thing that we are involved in. We have the privilege of being involved as God's covenant people, the new covenant, the children of God. He is our God, and we are the sheep of his pasture. Moreover, he said, I am the God of thy father. Notice this, how they are reminded. Now, I wasn't dismissive of history and I said, don't go groaning over the past, because we must remember our past and benefit from that, but not live in it. It's a different thing altogether. We live today. I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. I can understand that, can't you? It's not afraid in the sense that he didn't want to see him. He'd never had anything like this happen to him before. There had never been such a confrontation in his life before. And probably he had never heard of anybody having anything like this before, or any kind of real spiritual dealings. But it was happening to him. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt, and have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters. For, and listen to this, for I know their sorrows. Is that wonderful? For I know their sorrows, and I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of the land unto a good land and large, and unto a land flowing with milk and honey, unto the place of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel is come unto me, and I have also seen the oppression wherewith the Egyptians oppress them. Come now therefore, and I will send thee to Pharaoh. Oh, what a thought. You leave it there now. Come. Moses, it's not for nothing you're having this gracious experience. It's not for your entertainment that I've appeared to you or called you by your name. But I have work for you to do. I have a mission in life for you to perform. And so his long story begins with a very difficult people, weren't they? What did God often call them? Stiff-necked, do you remember? Stubborn, stiff-necked, awkward, reluctant, grumbling, groaning, moaning, murmuring. Yet they were his people and the sheep of his pasture. And what God can do with such poor material, he can create trophies of grace, and he can glorify his name. And in this account here, the man he's using is a man called Moses, who never thought for one moment that God had a plan for him. Yet looking back, you could see the hand of God had kept him from his birth. Now shall we pray? Almighty God and our Heavenly Father, we thank thee that we can come to thee in our Saviour's name, and we worship thee and praise thy most holy name, for there is none like unto thee. O Father, teach us how to draw near to thee. Teach us what it means to groan spiritually, that our groaning might be heard in heaven, and that the Holy Spirit himself might intercede for us with groanings that cannot be uttered and yet can be understood in glory, and thou know of our sorrows here, and how we are in great peril, O Lord, and yet we believe that in such a day as this thou canst confront any Pharaoh. Hear us, O Lord, for thy name's sake. Amen.